Okay, well, welcome to the Soleri Report. This is Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm pleased to be joined this evening by Dr. Joseph Farrell, who needs no introduction. We've been having a wonderful conversation on the Soleri Report about the breakaway civilization, and I wanted tonight to discuss oligarchies and their fronts, and that was Joseph's wonderful suggestion. But we want to illuminate sort of how the governance structure works, see if we can understand a little bit more about it, and then I thought is a wonderful way, a case study to help understand the dynamics and help you understand the historical context of how we got to where we are is to look a little bit more at the Nazis. And Joseph has written several very wonderful books about the Nazi group and how they've evolved beyond in the aftermath of World War II. So, Joseph, welcome to the Soleri Report.
Well, thank you, Catherine. Thanks for having me back on. We've got a tall order ahead tonight, but thanks for having me
back.
Well,
no, I think we just keep, you know, I think this is an ongoing conversation. I kind of feel like the you're going to become the Lord Byron of the breakaway civilization.
No. Now, I know my friend, co-author, Dr. Scott DeHart, would appreciate that analogy, especially since he wrote a book about Percy Shelley and his role in all this. But no, it's
really?
It's an excellent book. It's called Shelley Unbound. He's challenging the Mary Shelley idea that she actually authored Frankenstein, and he makes a pretty good case that's really kind of academic. What do we want to call it? Deception or something? but anyway, and it's important because you know that's an early book kind of about the whole subject of breakaway science and breakaway civilization and culture. So all important stuff.
Well, one of the reasons I really value being able to speak with you and to read your books is you seem to have the same framework and picture for the governance structure on planet Earth that I do. Now, I don't begin to understand it yet. I'm trying to understand it. Right, we're trying to understand it. But we have, you know, we've observed lots of patterns historically.
Right.
And we have a sense of how it behaves.
Right.
And, you know, to me, you know, I'm always really amazed when people get angry and say, we have to do this to governments and corporations, because to a certain extent, they're just fronts.
Right.
They're
right.
fronts for a deeper structure.
Yes.
And so maybe if you could just, we could start by you sharing a little bit about what you describe as oligarchies and their fronts and how you think this all works.
Well, I'm definitely of the opinion that oligarchy is a misunderstood phenomenon. But the way I look at it, Catherine, is we're dealing with at least a two-tiered structure, all right? At the very, very pinnacle, the structure itself is very informal. In other words, you're dealing with a network. You know, if you're into network theory, you're dealing with a multi-centered, polycentric, segmented, integrated network of informal personal contacts. And let me illustrate what I mean by that. I've referred to, in a couple of recent books and on several recent blogs, to a trip that occurred in 1928 when the then president of the Reichsbank, Hjalmar Schacht, traveled from Germany to this country to visit a friend of his by the name of Ben Strom, who at that time was, I believe, the governor of the New York Federal Reserve Bank. And Schacht records in his memoirs that Mr. Strom took him down into the vaults and was showing him all the stacked gold reserves, and then Schacht wanted to go visit the Reichsbank's gold reserves, and the staff of the Federal Reserve Bank nervously informed Mr. Strong that they couldn't find the Reichsbank's gold. Sounds like a familiar story. So
the Germans had such a hard time keeping a hold of their gold.
This seems to be a theme here, you know, and I think there's a story in that. But what I'm getting at here is that Schacht and Strong were personal friends, and that this is the way that at the very pinnacle of power things often operate. They operate by a network of close personal contact and things being done on this basis. And this has been true throughout history. If you turn the pages back and look at the Italian city-states, Venice and Genoa and Florence and so on, you'll see this tight, closely knit network of noble families, and they're all kind of intermarried and interbred, and they all know each other, and they all conduct their business on this kind of first name basis. And they're very protective of their position in Venice. And the reason I'm stressing the two-tiered nature of the structure of oligarchy is that if you go to Venice, they even at one point have a what's called the Golden Book. And the book is literally a list of nobility. And even in that book, it distinguishes between the longi, in other words, the nobility that had been around for just ages and ages and eons, and then the curti, the nobility that had entered into the circles of nobility by the accumulation of wealth and power and so on. So this is the first thing to understand, that oligarchy operates in a network of personal contacts based upon family, based upon class, in some cases based upon bloodline. All these things are very important. Now, at the
right,
second
genes
level,
and relationships, genes and intergenerational relationships count for a lot.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, at a second level that is also very, very closely intertwined with this informal level, at a second level, there are what I call the fronts. And these fronts consist of institutions that are very familiar to us. Corporations would certainly be one of the mechanisms, and particularly when you're dealing with Nazis or the wartime period, you're dealing with huge, huge cartels. And I'm thinking in particular of Interessen Gemeinschaft Farben Industrie, IG Farben. And
right.
The fact that this huge, huge company, I mean, it's so huge, Catherine, people don't really understand. You know, they think of IG Farben as this World War II thing that went quietly into the night in 1945. Okay.
Right.
But the reality is most people are shocked when I tell them that the IG Farben was only finally legally liquidated and dissolved in the year 2003.
Right.
In other words, this corporation was so huge, it was so enormous, it was so powerful that it's taken almost 60 plus years to look into all of its cartel arrangements, its licensing agreements, and so on and so forth, disentangle them all, and finally disband the corporation. And even when that's done, all said and done, the companies that went to make up IG Farben, little concerns like Bayer and
right.
Hoechst and BASF and so on, you know, these are still enormous corporations, and they're still international, and they're still around. So, you know, IG
right,
Farben
kind of morphs.
Yeah, exactly. It, you know, in a certain sense, it's still around. It's just operating in the guise of its subsidiaries, and we'll get to that in a minute. So corporations, big international corporations, are one of the hallmarks of oligarchy. Now, that said, I want to point out something that's very important for people to understand. When you're dealing with big, huge international concerns like Farben, you certainly are dealing with a multinational, but you're dealing with a multinational that had a very solidly nationalistic core and agenda. So in other words, even though it's a multinational, it's very definitely a German company reflecting German cultural values, German geopolitical goals, and so on and so forth. And I think the same has to be said to a certain extent of other multinational corporations, big investment banks. You know, Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank is a huge corporation, and it's going to have a British and Chinese perspective on things. That's just inevitable. The other front group that I think we have to take very, very close cognizance of in terms of looking at oligarchy and how it works are foundations. And I have not yet written anything about this in any of my books, but it's a hugely important part of the story because foundations, the fondi, it's actually a term from Latin and Italian. And in Italian, fondi meant precisely a family fortune, a family foundation, a family basis on which it operated. So in other words, it's very much a part of oligarchical thinking. And certainly by the 19th century, when you have the founding of the Carnegie Endowments and the Ford Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation and so on and so forth, you're dealing with enormously powerful entities that operate almost entirely outside the normal national tax structure and so on and so forth. So that's another important.
Well, what you're doing is you're sheltering intergenerational pools of capital.
Exactly.
From taxes,
exactly.
Both estate taxes and from, from normal investment taxes. If you
exactly.
look at how much you'd be paying in taxes, you instead take a small portion of that, and those are monies that are to be given away or spent on overhead. And what you do with that money is you use it very strategically to
yes.
both, there's a wonderful example of how the Ford Foundation operated in Latin America in concert with the University of Chicago efforts to kind of privatize everything.
Right.
And the Ford Foundation went in there and sort of bought up all the activists and kept them channeled in ways that kept them away from what I call the third rail. You know, so they
right.
couldn't touch any real power. It kept them busy, kept them occupied. And you see one of the many different ways that foundation resources are used to sort of organize the talent and get things going in the way that you want. And the knowledge management is at a much higher level.
Exactly.
You know, so you have your knowledge managers, but then you have your not-for-profits, your for-profits, your universities, you know, the guys you have in Congress, and you have them acting in concert in a way that achieves a very strategic result. And,
absolutely.
And, but what the foundation does is, you know, for if let's say 30% of your money would be going to taxes in a for-profit structure, instead you're only paying 5% out, so it's very reduced. You use that money very strategically in ways that justify how your for-profits are making money. It's terrific for control.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And you look like the good guy. And meantime,
exactly.
as long as that capital cycles back, you know, that's why when you get into the investment management of endowments, both for churches and for not-for-profits, you know, it's very much organized, so it has to go back into to finance the companies, you know, that basically the system wants financed.
Right, and I'm so glad you mentioned intergenerational accumulation in respect to foundations and keeping them tax-free, because this is actually, it may seem like a modern 19th century contrivance, au contraire, this is actually a medieval idea. And
right.
I'm thinking very specifically of two military orders in particular that had the same sort of ability to constitute themselves as extra jurisdictional entities that were outside of the normal channels of national or local taxation on the one hand, and were able to function on an international scale, and that's precisely the Hospitallers and the Templars. They had precisely
right.
this same sort of mechanism of accumulating and keeping wealth and channeling it for these types of purposes, management of knowledge, management of activities, and so on and so forth. So this is a very, very old thing in the oligarchical playbook. Now, the third thing at our second level that I want just very briefly to mention as the institutions whereby oligarchy functions is precisely governments, countries, nations. And that may seem like a tall stretch to most people, but again, it's really not all that unusual to say that if you look at it from the standpoint of the Middle Ages or Renaissance, when you have precisely these oligarchical forms of government and capital accumulation and management that you find in Genoa or Padua or Venice and so on. The thing that most people miss is that whole system really, as the Middle Ages collapse, spreads all over Europe. It spreads particularly into Germany and Holland and the United Kingdom eventually. So all of these things are not new. It's part of the old playbook. So, you know, the thing to keep in mind, folks, as we start talking about Nazis and all this, is you've got the informal arrangements at the deepest core.
Right.
And those arrangements are often transnational in nature. We need only think again of Schacht and Strong, or Fritz Thiessen in Germany, and Prescott Bush in this country, and so on and so forth, to understand what's going on. And then we have their networks of corporations and foundations and influences in government.
Right. And, you know, some of this, a lot of times when you hear people talk about this, it's a lot in some respects, it's a lot less, it's a lot more mundane than it sounds.
Right.
If you find yourself as a member of a family that is responsible for a great deal of stuff,
right.
You know, you're looking at all these different, you know, world operations need to be run. The trains need to run. The roads need to get built. And you're faced with the issue. You know, it's the same thing the pioneers were faced with, you know, when they went out on the prairie, which is, okay, well, how are we going to invent a town? How are we going to govern it? How are you going to do it? You know, and so what you soon discover is families are great at some things, but beyond a certain scale, you need a government. You need a company.
Precisely.
To just own and manage things. And so you create these things to own and manage. And, you know, sometimes they succeed and sometimes they fail. And when they fail, they don't just go down. You simply compost them and shift them and sell them and
right.
move people around. You know, it was very instructive for me when Hamilton Securities, my company in Washington, was targeted. I was amazed. They stole every drop, every person. You know, somebody went through and said, God, there's a lot of really valuable stuff here. Let's use all of it. You know?
Yes, exactly.
So it was kind of like Hamilton continued, but it was, you know, like an amoeba that was smashed and went off and, you know, merged with 20 other amoebas, and it all kept going. It's
yes.
just other people, you know, the money started going through other people's income statements and balance sheets, not mine.
Right.
So, you know, but all these things are simply operational vehicles, but they're not the power.
That's right.
Now,
that's right.
When you operate and run something, you have some power, but the real decision making is always behind that. It's a metastructure.
Yes, exactly. And that's what's so important for people to understand what we're talking about here, because it's not as if we are saying that there are no cabals or canards or conspiracies or something like this, but what we are trying to convey is that this is not a monolithic thing. There are always going to be factional interests that are dependent upon location, upon the geopolitics of the location. There's always going to be certain interests that are unique to one particular corporation as opposed to another. There's going to be interests from the class that, you know, is represented in the oligarchy. Are they from the governing class? Are they from the wealthy class? And so on. So my model, Catherine, that I use to try and convey really what all of this is the mafia. Because, you know,
right.
the mafia can sit down at the same conference table in nice plush paneled rooms and smoke cigars and have brandy and pat each other on the back. And then as soon as the meeting is over, each individual capo can go and order their hits on this or that individual and another family. So, you know,
right.
it's not a good structure. It's just there, and it's the reality of things.
Well, one of the things I found was very important to the structure is what happens over time is you have different pieces which are responsible for managing intergenerational pools of capital.
Yes.
And ownership of assets. And
yes.
all of those have risk issues.
Yes.
And what happens is, and I think there's not as much understanding of this as I wish there was, you know, when it comes to any business activity or any economic activity, you need 1,000 things to go right, and one thing going wrong can mess up the whole thing.
The whole thing, yes.
The whole thing. And it is very hard, I find, for the general population to understand whether it's running a company, whether it's running a government, whether it's running, you know, the metastructure behind that, whatever it is, how much risk these folks are dealing with, and over time how risk-averse they have become.
Right.
And it's because, you know, everything can go perfectly and one little thing can wipe out an entire intergenerational pool of capital. So
right.
A lot of the behavior is organized around, for example, the insurance industry, because it's the insurance industry's presence that, you know, protects millions of pots of capital within the intergenerational pools.
Right.
And so, you know, a lot of this organizes around, you know, putting walls between different pots of money and different kinds of risk. And then, of course, when the system doesn't work, what do you get? You get war.
Yes.
You know, that's when there's not enough and somebody's got to win and somebody's got to lose. And the war could be financial, a.k.a., you know, Madoff or MF Global, or, you know, it can literally turn into World War One and World War Two, because we know,
right,
you know, that the different parts of the metastructure, I mean, we know they finance both sides.
Yes.
And that's
yes.
One of the things that you really see in the Nazi story.
Oh, yes. You know, my favorite illustration of that, Catherine, is the Krupp concern, you know, the big German armaments manufacturer. Before World War II, Krupp bought a huge stake in the Swedish Bofors firm. All right. Now, that may, you know, that firm may not ring anybody's bells, but Bofors was the company that designed and built and then sold the licenses to build these quadruple-barreled 40-millimeter anti-aircraft guns. And if you look at American capital ships, or for that matter, any sort of ship, surface ship during World War II, it's these Swedish Bofors quadruple-barreled 40-millimeter anti-aircraft guns that you find on American ships, and for that matter, British ships. So, you know, here's Mr. Krupp in Essen, Germany, making all sorts of money from the Allies during the war, you know, at the same time that he's making money from the Nazis. So, you know, it's exactly so. It's exactly what you say. They straddle the fence, pardon me, on both sides of the war. And this is, you know, you raise something else that people need to understand, this idea of risk aversion from the long habit of these oligarchies. I think this, too, is at work today. You and I have discussed that it looks to us like the financial elites of the West are in some sort of hurry, if not in some instances showing little signs of perhaps panic of some sort or another, but at least in a hurry. And I think some of it has to do with this habit of risk aversion. They're so used to avoiding it, but now they're in a situation where they have to deal with it. And it's coloring their decisions. And certainly we see the same thing, you know, just to kind of segue into Nazis and World War II, we see the same operational behavior at the very top of the Nazi hierarchy right after the Stalingrad fiasco, because at this point it becomes very clear that a favorable military outcome to the war is increasingly unlikely, and it's certainly unlikely after the Battle of Kursk in 1943 on the Eastern Front. So militarily, this branch of the oligarchy, the Nazi branch, if you will, or the German branch, is thinking in terms of, all right, how do we stalemate the situation? And assuming that we can't, we have to make provision for the future, assuming that we can't. And this is precisely what begins to happen. They begin planning, making extreme long-term plans for post-war survival. And this is where it's so crucial for people to understand what happens, because if they don't understand this, it's like you've said over and over again, Catherine, you're dealing with a material omission.
Right.
The Nazis moved, I'm going to crawl out onto a limb here and say billions of dollars out of Europe within a matter of a few years. In one estimation alone, Catherine, just in Argentina, it's estimated that Juan Perón and Evita and Martin Bormann in $1945 controlled or had control of assets of all sorts amounting to, you know, cash assets, bullion, precious jewels, and so on, that they had control of assets of about $800 million in $1945 in Argentina alone.
Right.
So in other words, we're dealing with a pile of capital that really most people don't realize existed at the end of World War II. And this was
used. Remember, it's very possible. I mean, between the Vatican, members of the U.S. Intelligence Service,
right,
and the metastructure,
yes,
which had financed the Germans,
right,
there was a lot of institutional capacity to launder that money out.
Oh, yes, absolutely. This is just exactly where I was going with this, because the way it's looking to me, Catherine, is that you've got two post-war entities that are really setting up the system of finance that will prevail in the West for the next few decades, and they're doing so for specific long-term national security needs. And the two entities, one of them I describe in my various books as the Nazi International, or sometimes I call it the Fascist International. It's this group of industrialists, it's high-ranking Nazi Party members, and so on and so forth, that continue after the war to have their own kind of extraterritorial state and to pursue their own goals. And they do so by means of this vast hidden slush fund of capital. But their problem is it's so huge that they cannot possibly keep it entirely secret. They have to have the participation of the very powers that have just defeated them in order to launder all that money and make use of it.
Okay, so let me try.
Go ahead.
Finish, then I'll go.
Okay, well, this is precisely what's happening on the other side, because I think what you have in terms of the Allied powers, and particularly in the United States, is you have the sudden recognition between 1945 and 1947 for specific reasons that we can get into perhaps. You have the recognition that, hey, there's all of this Axis loot out there, both Nazi and Japanese. And we are confronted with a monolithic threat in terms of the Communist Bloc, at least as far as they perceived it. And they were not in a position, having just fought a world war, to confront that threat directly, nor were they strong enough or capable enough to do so. So they had to finance a long-term containment and rollback strategy. That's first of all. The second thing they were confronted with in terms of the thinking of American planners was precisely the existence of this Nazi group, some of which was independent of them and clearly pursuing their own objectives. So they had to figure out where that group was, how do we address it, how do we deal with it. And then the third thing they had to deal with, of course, was the UFO. You and I have talked about this many times, because that was the most clear and pressing national security threat in 1947, and continued to be so for several decades afterward. So they had to have financing to finance a long-term communist containment and rollback strategy, number one. And they also had to finance the technology to emulate UFO performance should it prove hostile, as it was certainly doing in a number of cases. So I think the deal was struck with the devil, Catherine. I think that President Truman put the national security establishment of the United States into the banking business by using all of that Axis loot, making it top secret, and using contacts in the Meta group, in that informal group of oligarchs that ran into Sullivan and Cromwell on Wall Street and the various investment banking houses and so on, to launder that money. And that's precisely where I think some of the origins of the financial difficulties that we're dealing with today begins.
Right. Well, let me try and say it another way, because to me, what I see is a meta structure which basically finances the U.S. government mm-hmm. and England and Germany and the Soviet Union,
mm-hmm.
you know, and profits mightily from the war. It's almost like, I used to work with investment banks where they put two teams on the same thing and see who would kill each other and who would win. And, you know, it was almost,
yeah.
you know, they wanted to, you know, it was kind of a Darwinian, okay, let's ask two people to do the, or two teams to do the same thing and see who kills each other and who gets it done. And, you know, it was, you know, so you see this meta structure, which is on one hand financing but playing divide and conquer.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it's clear that the Anglo-American alliance wins, you know, they bring the Nazis back into the meta structure, make their deals with them, and
mm-hmm.
profit. You know, rather than let the Nazis get destroyed and the Anglo-Americans get all the money, they
mm-hmm.
simply subsume it, and they move some into the American piece, some elsewhere. But everybody's still working for the meta structure, if you will. Now,
right.
That's not to say that one guy's in control in it. It's not organic. But the meta structure, you know, is playing them all and playing them off against each other and
oh, yes.
doesn't want the Americans to threaten it. They don't want the American victory to make the American subsidiary too big in the meta structure.
Yes, and I think, yes, I wholeheartedly agree with that. And I think that what you're seeing is a bit of pushback from the other components of that meta structure. You know, I used to tell people when I went to conferences to try and show the structure of this Nazi international component of it is that, okay, you know, the Rothschilds and the Rockefeller interests made their peace with the Nazis in the Bilderberg, early Bilderberg meetings, and that's what I think they were for. But I've always pardon me, put it out there with this caveat, and that is when you're making deals with the likes of Martin Bormann, you're making deals with Dick Cheney without the worm
right.
in term. You know, in other words, at some point, you know, the mafia illustration comes to mind again, because at some point that marker is going to come due. And you're dealing with an organization that has no moral scruples. You're dealing with an organization that has a vast underground kind of intelligence network that can get things done, you know, and bust the kneecaps, so to speak.
Well, I would say it this way. They're very smart.
Yes.
They're very organized. They think long term. And
oh, yes.
they are lacking in, you know, they're lacking in a certain kind of compassion. They
right.
don't empathize. You know, they look at many parts of the human race like, you know, you would look at a chicken.
Right.
They don't look at themselves as the same species.
No, they don't. And I think this is something that people have to understand about at least the Western component of this meta structure. You don't have to look very far or very long to see that within the Anglo-American component of it, you certainly have a racist component. You know, these were the big sponsors of eugenics and so on and so forth. And you certainly have an undertow in some circles within that elite of anti-Jewishness and so on and so forth. And of course, you know, you don't have to look very long or hard to find that with the German elite or the Nazis. So in a certain sense, they're making common cause. But you said something else that brought to my mind another hypothesis that people might want to bear in mind, and that is that if you look at the interwar period, both in Europe and the United States, and then look at what happens, it appears that this metastructure is also running some sort of grand sociological experiment, because you have the same structure involved putting the Bolsheviks into power inside of Russia. And then,
right.
of course, later on, they put the National Socialists into power in Germany. And then the same group finances Roosevelt, a kind of, you know, New Deal soft socialism in the United States.
They're
so it appears, yeah, exactly.
They're prototyping. They're trying different.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, they're running some sort of. Well, yeah, you said it best. Prototyping. They're running a social experiment, and I think that in a certain sense the results didn't go the way they wanted to. I do think that the intention was to have Germany at least win the war in the East, which ultimately proved unfeasible, and there are a number of other things that Hitler did that indicated that he wasn't about to play ball according to the rules. But yeah, this metastructure is there. It's very powerful. And the thing that's so hard for people to wrap their minds around, Catherine, is that as far as the Nazis go, my hypothesis is very, very simple. Number one, they survived the war.
I have to stop you right here.
Uh-huh.
Because one of the things I never grokked. I never understood until I looked at Nazi International again last night. One of the things I want you to do is to list out all the books you've written on these topics. But Nazi International, you published, the title is Nazi International, The Nazis' Postwar Plan to Control Finance, Conflict, Physics, and Space.
Right.
And you published, when did you publish? 2008?
I think it was 2008, somewhere around.
What I had not focused on was the fact that when the Germans surrendered, it was the German military. It was not the Third Reich, and the Nazi
right.
Party was not involved, which
right.
meant the German, if this is correct, and I'm assuming it is because you are an Oxford-trained scholar, the German government never surrendered.
That's right.
Now, this is not a little thing. This
no,
is
it's
big,
not.
Big,
it's not a little thing at all.
Because that means the metastructure didn't even bother to bankrupt or compost the subsidiary.
No.
It just went off someplace else, and you didn't even have to change the board minutes in the corporate book. You know what I mean?
That's right. I'm so glad you put it that way, because you know you're one of the few people that really latched on to the significance.
Well, I have to tell you, if you are the corporate secretary of the metastructure, it is a huge pain to have to compost the whole thing, you know, taking down the legal structure. If you can just
right.
transfer the legal structure over and not be bothered with this Sherman drug of doing it without that, it's much cheaper and efficient. And so I must tell you, I said, this is unbelievable that they were able to do this.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's
well,
how powerful this group is.
You know, this is something, and I'm so glad you caught on to it, Catherine, because this is something I put in that book just to see if anybody would really pay attention. Because most people, the significance of it either escapes them, or if they get it, they just don't believe it. Okay?
Oh, I believe
it. So let me read the list of books that are dealing with the whole subject of Nazis. And I understand that this is a lot of books, folks, but this is such a huge story and it's such a significant one that to write it all into a 5,000-page book.
You cannot understand the breakaway civilization unless you understand
right.
the aftermath, the Nazis and the aftermath of the war and the evolution within the military-industrial complex.
No, absolutely. You cannot. It's impossible. But the
right.
first book, and I'll try and summarize the subject matter. The first book was a book called Reich of the Black Sun, and the subtitle is Nazi Secret Weapons and the Cold War Allied Legend. And the subject matter of the book is about, and I'm not even going to explain it, but I'll just toss it out there. The subject matter of that book is about the successful German atom bomb program. Okay. And I know that should set off alarm bells right there. The second book in that series is a book called The SS Brotherhood of the Bell, And then the subtitle of that is The Nazis' Incredible Secret Technology, NASA's Nazis, JFK, and Magic 12. That book is about just very, very avant-garde Nazi black projects research that definitely carried on after the war. The third book is a book called Secrets of the Unified Field, The Philadelphia Experiment, The Nazi Bell, and The Discarded Theory. And then the fourth book is called The Philosopher's Stone. Subtitle is Alchemy and the Secret Research for Exotic Matter. Then The Nazi International, which is the book that we'll be getting back to in just a moment about post-war Nazi survival and the surrender and all that. Then the book after that is Roswell and the Reich. That's a very important book, even if you disagree with the premise, because it goes into the U.S. national security state and why it was so concerned about Nazis after the Roswell incident. Then another book called LBJ and the Conspiracy to Kill Kennedy, because I spend a lot of time in that book with the Nazi angle of Kennedy's murder, which most assassination researchers want to rush right by, if not deal with it at all. And then, of course, the final three books, Saucers, Swastikas, and Psyops, which came out a couple years ago, and then Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations, and then the most recent one, Covert Wars and Clash of Civilizations. So this is a huge story, and there's lots of bits and pieces to connect, and I've tried to lay it out there as carefully and logically as I can. Now let's get back to the surrender.
Okay.
Most people are totally unaware that when Germany surrendered during World War II, number one, it did so twice.
You there would was think an East Front and a West Front.
Yeah, there was an East Front surrender. There was a West Front surrender. And in each of the surrenders, the West Front surrender occurred on May 7th in Reims, France, and it was signed on behalf of Germany solely by Colonel General Alfred Jodl, who was the Wehrmacht chief of staff for operations, all right? And Colonel General Jodl, of course, went on eventually to be hung by the Nuremberg tribunals. But he signed on behalf of the German military, okay, the Wehrmacht. And then there was a surrender a day later that was arranged in Berlin because the Russians wanted a higher-ranking member present at the surrender than what they had available to them in Reims. So the whole surrender is reenacted in Berlin a day later, and this time you have Colonel General Stumpf signing on behalf of the Luftwaffe. You had Field Marshal Keitel signing on behalf of the German Army, and then you had Admiral Friedeberg signing on behalf of the German Navy. Okay. Now, this is all very important because when you look at the surrender documents and compare them to the Japanese surrender, in the case of Japan, the Allies made darn sure to have representatives signing and to make it sure that it was understood in the document, spelled out in the surrender document itself, that the signatories for Japan were signing on behalf of the emperor, they were signing on behalf of the Imperial Japanese General Staff, that they were signing on behalf of the Admiralty, and they were signing on behalf of the Imperial Diet. Okay, so in other words, we were making darn sure that everybody knew that all of Japan was surrendering. Okay.
Well, but here's what's very interesting. They left the Japanese government entirely intact, reporting to MacArthur until the Americans backed out and it went back to reporting to the metastructure. Okay.
Right, exactly.
So I'm just looking at this like corporate subsidiary politics, whereas in Germany, you
yes.
shift the Nazis and spread them out throughout the metastructure and create
right.
sort of a new cross-cut internationally. You create a non-place-based government that's global
yes.
and
yes.
has certain kinds of responsibilities. I would submit one of them was the Latin American drug cartels. But
bingo.
And you basically leave the government intact, but you make it not place-based and leave Germany to do some new reinvention. And you integrate a lot of first of all, you take the entire German intelligence network in the East and simply shift it into the new American CIA, which you create.
Yes.
And then put a whole bunch of it over at NASA and within the military-industrial complex and spread it around the universities, but in a funny kind of way that creates increased power for the metastructure within
yes.
the Anglo-American alliance, as opposed to just putting the Anglo-American alliance in charge of the
right.
Nazis and the Reich government. Do you see what I mean?
Oh, yeah,
so,
absolutely.
So you get much more of a merger.
Yes,
than
it's a merger. It's not just that. You know, I've said for many years to people that I know that this is very, very difficult even to comprehend, but what you're dealing with is an extraterritorial fascist state because
right.
the influence that these post-war Nazis, and it's not just Nazis, you know, we're dealing with Ustashi, Italian fascists, Belgian Rexists, and, you know, Hungarian fascists and so on. So, in other words, it's literally a fascist international. The influence, as you just pointed out, that this has within the American post-war national security structure is absolutely enormous. It's almost incomprehensible. It's not just the CIA that's running, you know, Nazi spies in the Soviet Union and doing so with the same former German general. It's to the point, as I point out in Roswell and the Reich, that the Germans inside of NASA managed to reproduce and recreate lock, stock, and barrel the entire command structure within NASA that they had in the Third Reich. It's
right.
It's blatant. And
you
as
know,
you pointed
it's almost
out,
like the metastructure at the end of World War II, the Anglo-American alliance controlled far too high a percent of the resources.
Right.
It's almost like the metastructure said, look, we don't trust them to do this. You
right.
know, let's get all these great guys we love over here and stick them in, you know, so that we have a little bit more alignment between our values and, you know, and
exactly.
make sure that, you know, too many of these people have fallen for all this Scottish Enlightenment, and we need to be careful here.
And who better to do it than the Nazis? You know, I totally agree with that. And I think there's a great deal of truth with that because you are looking at a balance of power structure. And this is why I think this historical background is so important to see why we're looking at the same fissure lines today between Europe, you know, the German-led part of Europe on the one hand and the Anglo-American part of Europe on the other, with all of this gold repatriation story and so on and so forth. And you mentioned another
right.
very important component, Catherine, that I want to stress here. In addition to the fact that you have no signatory at the German surrenders officially representing the Reich government, in other words, after Hitler had transferred power to Grand Admiral Dönitz, Dönitz was right up there in Flensburg in Denmark. So in other words, it would not have been all that difficult for the Allies to bring him down from Schleswig-Holstein to Berlin and have him present at the signing ceremony, delay it a couple of days, get Dönitz there and signing on behalf of the government of the Reich as Reich president, all right? But this was not done. So to my mind, this is a deliberate omission that indicates precisely the scenario that you're suggesting is in play. And the second thing that they don't have signing on behalf of the Nazis, they don't have anyone representing the Nazi Party or any
right.
of its subsidiary organizations signing the surrender of the party. And, you know, you would think that the Allies who go on to criminalize the Nazi Party at the Nuremberg tribunals post facto would have fought to put in a codicil in the surrender that the Nazi Party recognizes itself to be a criminal organization and hereby disbands and abolishes itself, signed so-and-so representing the Partei Chancellery. None of this was done. So So when you have those two examples, this to me indicates that the fix is in and this omission was deliberate. And when you look at the structure of the post-war metastructure, with the penetration of so many of these European fascists into the positions of power and influence within American intelligence and within the American military and within black projects, research, and so on of all types, that to me indicates, yes, that you're dealing with a structure that's not only a metastructure, but it is now willing to, so to speak, openly embrace a connection with the criminal underworld. And it's very important for people to understand that the Nazis made this arrangement with the Latin American drug cartels very quickly after the end of the Second World War. And by the 1970s, there's a book your listeners should examine. It's called The Great Heroin Coup. And it's by an author by the name of Henrik Krüger. I refer to this book in some of my works. This is a superbly researched book about the restructuring of the drug trade by this international fascist element, by the military-industrial complex during the 1970s, precisely to guarantee them a continued flow of capital for their projects.
Right. Right.
It's a huge story.
It is a huge story. One of the most important decisions after the World War II was a clear decision was made, you know, executed by the U.S. intelligence agencies to mm-hmm. open up America to drug trafficking.
Yes.
And you're talking about, at the time, the largest single consumer market in the world.
Yes.
And that's, you know, if you watch Godfather 1, Godfather 2, Godfather 3, what you see is, you know, what will happen to the old mafia if they don't go along with this.
Exactly.
And they will, right. And increasingly, over time, what you see is, as time goes by, more and more that money is shifted out of the underground groups into the corporate sort of bureaucracy, because the metastructure needs more and more efficiency. And frankly, as technology develops, you know, you need something much more streamlined.
Oh yeah.
So
and let's look at something else with this metastructure, Catherine, and this may help illustrate what you're saying with the ties with the corporation, with the mafia, with these underground Nazi groups. To kind of reinforce this idea of the informal nature of some of these relationships. There is an incident that I reported in the Nazi International that to my mind, every time I think of this, Catherine, I'm just literally blown away. And this is during the early 60s, I think around 1967, somewhere in there. Martin Bormann wrote three checks. Now, remember, this guy's supposed to be dead, okay? So, and not only dead, but just to make sure he's dead, the Nuremberg tribunals, you know, tried him in absentia and sentenced him to death. Okay, so if he's not dead, we want him dead. Okay, at least officially. But anyway, around 1967, Martin Bormann writes three checks. Okay, pay to the order of, you know. The checks are drawn on Manufacturers Hanover Bank and Chase Manhattan. And they're cleared by Deutsche Bank in Argentina, in Buenos Aires, Argentina. And here's the kicker. These checks are written over and cleared over his own signature. In other words, there isn't even the attempt to disguise the fact he's cashing checks on major American banks, and a major
right.
German bank is clearing it for him. So in other words, you know,
right.
that really right there, folks, says that what we're talking about in terms of the informal relationships of this huge metastructure with penetration into banking, into intelligence, into the underworld, and all of this, it's really all true. And it boggles the mind, I realize, but it's like you've said so many times, Catherine, if you don't consider all of this, especially in terms of financial planning, it's a material omission.
Right. The train tracks of the global economy are the clearing and settlement systems.
Yes.
And there's no way that the Nazis could have shifted out the amount of money they did and it be protected unless that system, which is absolutely controlled by the meta structures.
Yep, absolutely.
Unless that system did it for them.
Well, so, let's remember, in that respect, Catherine, let's remember one more important thing about the clearing systems. The mechanism that the Nazis used in terms of international settlements and clearing to get all of this accomplished was precisely the Bank of International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland. And guess who helped set that up? Our good old friend Hjalmar Schacht.
I told you one of my favorite stories about a reporter, a wonderful reporter I know, who had lunch with somebody who was very, very high up in the DEA, who after many years had finally faced how things really worked. And he looked at her very sadly and said, "Let's face it. All the wire transfers are batched and end up running through the New York Fed, so they know where every penny is."
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, he'd finally figured it out.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I've been saying for a number of months in public blogs, with the pushback from the BRICS countries eventually, they're going to attempt and going to have to set up their own kind of parallel clearing system because, you know, as you say, that's the train tracks that make international finance work.
Right. Well, but will they be allowed to? I'm not clear.
Well, that's the important question. Yeah, exactly. Will they be allowed to?
Right. So let's go back and talk about some of the things that happened, because I want to make sure people understand some of the steps. At the end of World War II, we see, now help me with the pronunciation, is it Gerlins? Organization in the East. So we have the German intelligence operation.
Reinhard
picked
Galen.
Up Galen and moved into the CIA with the agreement negotiated between Dulles and Galen that Galen's entire network reports directly to him.
Yes.
And so he suddenly becomes the commander of American intelligence in Eastern Europe.
Yes.
I mean, this is why I'm saying it's a merger.
It's a merger. And, it's not the, you know, there's official history tries to explain this, Catherine, by saying, well, you know, at the end of World War II, we suddenly realized that we're going to need spies inside the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe. And the only people that had them are Nazis. So, you know, by golly, we'd better cut our deal with the devil or
was
we're not
going to know. Or did the meta structure want to protect the Soviet Union when they were, you know?
I think both. I think, you know, if you look at the way the Nazis play the West and the East off against each other after the war, I think it's because precisely what you suggest, that there was a certain amount of protection of the Soviet Union involved. But
right. Well, Dulles, you know, the Soviet Union was their investment, and Dulles worked for the meta structure. He never worked for the Americans.
No, I totally agree with you there.
Right.
I think what you have, Catherine, you know, just to kind of put the icing on the cake for people here, it seems inconceivable that America would have made the deal to allow the entire human boots on the ground intelligence operation of the CIA to be nothing but the former Nazi military intelligence organization on the Eastern Front. But
under the control of the
same German general.
So the compensation policies and bonuses of all the Nazis were controlled by the Nazis.
Yes, exactly.
And the slush funds and all the money they garnered doing all their whatever they do, that was all, I mean.
They just rolled it under new management. But it's as you say, Dulles worked for the meta structure, not for America, and that's really what's going on here. But to kind of illustrate just how bad it is, and I realize, folks, that this is going to sound completely over the top, but you have to go out there and dig into some people like Carl Willoughby, an American historian, that actually was just as dumbfounded as anybody else when he learned that this was the deal that had been made with Nazi intelligence. But to show you how bad it was, you can look up him or you can look up Chris Simpson in a book called Blowback.
Oh,
Galen's organization at one point, Catherine, was so influential in post-war American politics that the assessments of Soviet intention and capabilities that his organization was gathering were passed on to Washington, where they were simply retyped and handed directly to President Truman without any vetting whatsoever. That's how influential it was. And worse, if you go to the relationship between the American elite and Galen's organization in the early 60s, what you find is Clint Murchison and Hunt in Dallas. Their intelligence connections, when you dig long enough, you'll find that their intelligence connections are General Galen. In other words, West German intelligence.
Right.
So the direction, you know, the connection between Galen and his organization and ultimately the assassination and murder of President Kennedy is very direct. So you're dealing here, folks, with something huge. And I know it sounds just horrendous and inconceivable, but we have to remember this metastructure is interested not just in finance, but it's confronted with a post-war geopolitical situation with communism that they have to contain and roll back. And in that respect, you know, you're going to have the help of Europe, like it or not, and the only infrastructure of power that is there in Europe at the time to deal with is unfortunately Nazi. So all of this is playing into the mix.
Right. So I think that the thing that makes it challenging to understand the metastructure and the different factions, whether they be governments or corporations, is, you know, we have been raised on a mythic picture of how the world works.
Yes.
And part of it is the mythic picture oversimplifies things. Because if you look at what we're describing, it's very organic. It's very complex.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of it organizes around trying to manage and govern all sorts of turf.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't, you know, someone else will grab it and will. And so it's, you know, it's not, a lot of this is not as nefarious as it sounds or seems.
Right.
And what we come back to again and again, of course, is what is really going on with the UFOs. Because one of the things that creates a lot of risk and opportunity is new technology. Somebody gets a new weapon. A lot of the story of World War II is the effort to get the atomic bomb and the danger of what can happen if the other group gets it and you don't.
Right.
And so you see this push. One of the things that it got integrated after the war was, of course, all the scientists.
Yes.
So we see, you know, rocket scientists, space scientists, you know, all sorts of different scientists sucked into the American government and agencies and the universities. And because certainly nobody wanted to lose that talent to the Soviet Union. So it was, if we don't get it, the Soviet Union will, but we want that knowledge. It's much more, you know, even the people who believed in an American national security felt that America was much better off having that knowledge than you know, hanging them at Nuremberg.
Well, let's go further, because this is an excellent point that you're raising here, and I hope that people will understand now that what I'm about to say is meant to flesh out the factions at play in this metastructure. Because as you say, it, as far as the American component of this metastructure is concerned, it was much better to have all these Nazi rocket scientists and airplane scientists and so on working for us than for the Russians. But let's look at that same question of the technology of World War II from the standpoint of the Nazis, all right? if you look at what happens, if you're really thoroughly familiar with what happens inside of the Third Reich during the 12 years of its existence, it is just this unbelievable, overwhelming explosion of technology. If you
right.
stop and think of all of the things that we take for granted in today's modern warfare, drones, cruise missiles, surface-to-air missiles, heat-seeking missiles, acoustic-guided torpedoes, you know, all of the stuff that we think are products of, you know, good old American know-how and so on. All of these things had some prototypical development inside the Third Reich during the World War, and some of them are actually deployed, all right? Now, as the war begins to turn against Germany, the Nazis, if you look carefully at what's going on as the war closes in Europe, you'll see an interesting pattern. The Soviets are getting the middle echelon technicians and managers of the various projects. And these are people in their hundreds that are capable of reconstructing the documents trails. The Soviets are not getting the big names, okay? If you look at what we get the big name rocket scientists, we get the big name aerodynamicists, and so on and so forth. But interestingly enough, and this is the reason I wrote Nazi International, their most sensitive projects, they keep to themselves and run independently after the war. And I suspect that the nexus there, Catherine, is a kind of independent Nazi nexus directly to the crowned heads of American corporations, bypassing the American military and intelligence complex altogether. So you've
right.
got the paperclip Nazis in this country working, quote-unquote, for us. You've got the Nazis inside the Soviet Union helping the Soviets reconstruct, you know, all the rocket projects and so on. And then you've got those independent groups in Latin America that are doing their own thing.
and they compete and cooperate.
And they compete and cooperate. Yeah, this is the other part of the equation that, you know, at first glance it seems so puzzling, but when you put it in terms of the metastructure that you're talking about, it makes perfect sense.
Okay, so let me tell you a little story and then extrapolate from it and then come back to what we're talking about now.
Mm-hmm.
When I was Assistant Secretary at HUD, all of the payment systems and information systems that was run, or the largest pot of it was run by one contractor, who is the largest defense contractor in the United States. And they were paid in 1989, $150 million approximately, to run the information systems. Now, at HUD, you had two big pots of money. You had a pot of money, you had about $50 to $100 billion a year of mortgage insurance being put out. You know, according to the formal budget, I would say it was much larger. And then you had what's called Section 8 subsidy, which is housing subsidy,
mm-hmm.
in the tens of billions of dollars, okay? So they're running the information systems and payment systems on this, including collecting up a closing document from every real estate closing in the country. So you have a database on all the real estate in the country, all the mortgages, everything. Okay?
Uh-huh.
Now, when I was Assistant Secretary, I tried to get basic data from the contractor, and
right.
I couldn't get it. Okay? And the
oh,
reason
my
I
word.
Couldn't get it is they didn't report to the political appointees or the line management, they reported to the metastructure. Okay?
Oh, my
now,
word.
Right. Now, what happened, then I came back in several years later, Hamilton Securities was hired as lead financial advisor, and on several occasions, we were ordered to get that data to do things we were required to do under the contract. Again, that same defense contractor refused to give us the data. I paid a team of people over $100,000 to go, like, get the data, and we couldn't get the data, and it ended up in screaming wars Now, what I will tell you is I think there was a lot of money laundering and other things going on.
Sure.
And there's certainly a lot of fraud going on in those programs. But now, obviously, then my company ended up in having litigation, and it was very interesting because at one point our offices were seized under a phony pretext. We were required to turn over every file we had personally and professionally. They got a hold of everything, and then after they pulled out, I went in at night and got our main server. And the next day, the team from the government came in and said to the guy who worked for me, where's the main server? And Ozzy said, you know, we took it last night. And he said, you can't have that. You are not allowed to have the data. I'm under instructions. You are not allowed to have a copy. And that's because we had data of the mortgage portfolios.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they were trying to get back, well, it's a much longer story, but suffice it to say that I then tried to warn people of the fact that there was no one from the government, whether a political appointee or a bureaucrat, who was in control and increasingly understood even the financial flows within the agency.
Right.
Because all of the money was managed. So literally several years later, I said to the guy who'd been the top sort of civil servant within the entire HUD system, he had retired, I said, I will pay you a dollar if you can find someone who can answer. We came up with a group of questions about the basic fundamental economics and budgets. And I said, you will not be able to find any person in the budget office or anywhere in the HUD system who can answer these questions. And he didn't call me back. He waited until he was coming through town, and I went to have dinner because he didn't want to say this over the phone. He said, there is absolutely no one there who understands the basic financial flows. The defense contractors are completely 100% in control, not only of the information systems and the payments, but of all the knowledge.
Yep.
Now, that was 2002, okay?
Oh, man.
Now, what I have to tell you is these defense contractors are running all of the government agencies, not just the defense agencies, all the domestic. And from what I can tell, they report directly to the metastructure.
Yes. Yeah. It doesn't surprise me because, you know, we've talked about this before, Catherine. It's the actual control of the information. It's not just the control
right.
of the flow of it, but the control of the actual physical equipment that's processing the data.
Right. So hold this thought for a second.
Uh-huh.
You have 21 plus government agencies. They all have defense contractors who are running the information systems who have the ability to suck that in up into one database.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
You know, run by the metastructure, not even by the US government.
Right.
Right.
And that explains why, and this, you know, we've talked about this, that explains why the public government is so non-responsive. You know, people are wondering why they keep voting and nothing changes. Well, this is part of the explanation why. Now, when we factor into the defense contractors controlling the physical equipment that processes the data and feeds the data to the metastructure, we have to remember that again, there were these wartime ties between IBM and so on and
right.
the Nazi elite. And it's been my suspicion, Catherine, I don't have much evidence, but it's been my suspicion that in terms of the flow of this vast amount of data, that some of this data makes its way to the Vatican. You and I have talked about the Vatican and its role in all of this. And
mm-hmm.
I'm convinced that there's some deep penetration from this international fascist organization, entity, whatever you wish to call it, into the management of all this data flow. I'm absolutely convinced. And the reason I say that...
Oh, me too. Yeah, no,
is,
absolutely.
Well, the reason I say that is, again, I'm going back to the fact that the Nazis made such a successful penetration of the Bank of International Settlements during the war. And I have been unable to find... really that influence waned all that much after the war. So I think that's one nexus. You're having to look at the international establishments, IMF, World Bank, BIS, and so on. I think you're going to find a lot going on there that still has not been adequately comprehended. Let's put it that way.
This is why I keep saying the NSA is not the problem.
No, it isn't. It isn't, you know, I think that actually, Catherine, has been something of a tempest in a teapot. I think we're looking at something very, very different. I do think there's a financial aspect to the NSA spying, but
absolutely. The ultimate insider trading machine, as far as I'm concerned, is at the metastructure. It may not be at the NSA.
Right. Yeah, I agree with you there. I think that's absolutely true. Absolutely true. I think we have to look very carefully at things like Bitcoin in that regard, because like you, I have deep suspicions of that whole thing. It has all the appearance of being exactly what you've outlined there is kind of a front for all of that, and I'm deeply suspicious of it.
Let me just mention one thing, and let's come back to Bitcoin, because I think that's very important.
Mm-hmm.
Two of the books I always encourage people to read if they're interested in these topics, one is Trading with the Enemy by Charles Higham. It just
yes.
lets you see the metastructure umbrella, the both sides and during World War II. But the other is Edwin Black's wonderful book, IBM and the Holocaust, because you see
yeah.
the way that databases make things possible, particularly genocide, because
yeah.
it was really a database operation designed and developed with the help of IBM that made the Holocaust workable.
Yeah.
And the thing that is, to me, powerful about this, and I wrote an article called The Data Beast, which I encourage people to take a look at. It's important to understand right now that IBM was the lead contractor on the latest big census, and they're one of the lead software developers on the smart meters.
Yep.
And we have a very aggressive, almost violent rollout of smart meters all across the country.
Yep.
And this whole idea of the Internet of Things. And if you understand the database operation behind the Holocaust, what you begin to realize is the database operation behind the war on drugs and some other things in this country that to me are simply a friendly fascist version of the same kind of genocide.
Oh, yeah,
absolutely. You know, it starts to get very scary. And that's one of the reasons that I'm always very cautious about anything that's digital, let alone all digital. I built a company in Washington that was entirely, it was all digital. It was we had the integration of telephony with the computers. When MCI decided to integrate their telephones and computers, they came to study how we did it because we were so advanced. And then I discovered, how well that works when someone else can slap you with a subpoena and seize your hardware.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's when I discovered the reality of digital, how the digital world really works. But that takes us to Bitcoin, because here we have a currency that, that no bank has to be responsible. Nobody is responsible to produce deposit insurance. Nobody has reserve requirements.
Right.
It's supposedly completely out of control, but every coin, has a historical record from the beginning. Imagine getting into litigation where the government – you have people from the Department of Justice that are willing to swear that the record from the beginning is, whatever they make up. In the meantime, it's going to
yep.
take you 11 years and $6 million to prove that it's not true.
Yeah, exactly.
So, right. So you're talking about something that if you look at all the different financial protections afforded you by a bank deposit today, they're all stripped away. They're all
yeah.
stripped away into something which is entirely digital.
And not under your control.
Right.
Yeah. I wholeheartedly agree. I've had people, Catherine, on my website email me constantly what I think about Bitcoin. And obviously I haven't studied it to the extent you have, but I always tell them I'm extremely cautious, and there's a reason I haven't said anything about it, because I don't even want to I don't even really want to promote it even by drawing attention to it. Let's put it that way.
Right. Well, here's what I see. I've seen the metastructure roll things out. You know, the metastructure loves to prototype and roll things out and make it look like it's a grassroots phenomena.
Right.
And from everything I've seen, the Bitcoin is brought to you by the metastructure.
Oh, yeah.
First of all, if the metastructure didn't want it, you know, you and I would never have heard about it, or barely.
Exactly.
It'd be long gone. Okay.
Exactly.
So I don't think this is coming from the American intelligence agencies. I think this is coming out of the metastructure.
Yeah, I agree.
Some part of the metastructure. And if you think they can't control this from behind the scenes, you're dreaming.
Yeah, well, precisely. You know, if you're dealing, you know, let's just stop and think. If you're dealing with the NSA alone, with the computational power that it has to monitor every electronic communication in the world and archive it for years and years,
right,
then Bitcoin is not safe from that standpoint alone. You know,
right.
And like you, I'm extremely skeptical not only of that, but of any digital, all digital, cashless.
Right. To me, anything that's 100% digital is completely untrustworthy.
Yeah.
Not to say
same
it's
here.
Not useful.
Right.
But I would never have in an all digital currency more than I could afford to lose entirely.
Right.
You know, quickly.
Yeah, I agree. You know, to show you how I'm thinking, Catherine, on that score, every time I go to my bank, they give me a little computer printout. I keep those because that's my hard copy. You know, I'm not trusting my bank, you know, if they should get, you know, an electromagnetic pulse from whoever and all their digital is wiped out. You know, that little piece of paper is with their logo on it is a legal document that tells me and tells them and tells the government for that matter how much money I'm supposed to have in there. I don't trust anything entirely digital. I just don't. And by the same
token, I'm alive today because the government consistently tried to falsify evidence and they couldn't because I had a copy of everything.
Yep.
I had a copy of everything and I had very paperful copies of everything. And not only that, forgive the way I'm going to describe this. We had at Hamilton something called a white guys with ties budget. And on all the major strategic issues, we paid, you know, to be perfectly blunt, someone who worked for or was a 33-degree Mason to bless it.
Right.
So there was no way I was going down unless, you know, for each one of those things, you had to take down a partner at Price Waterhouse or Coopers and Lybrand or this law firm or that law firm. And it was really funny because the audit committee, the board would meet and they'd say, you know, we have $250,000 we're spending on people to affirm stuff we already know. We don't need these guys. And I would say, that is our white guys with tie budget. You are not going to touch that.
Yeah, I don't.
And I'm alive today because of the white guys with tie budget.
Well, exactly. And, you know, I don't blame you. This rate, you know, this whole move to put everything on digital currency and so on and so forth, there's another angle of it, Catherine, that, you know, since we're talking about this in respect to the metastructure, that also disturbs me. Because I ran into this with my last book, Covert Wars and Clash of Civilizations. I got an email from a reader of mine that has been following all these books, and he said, oh, by the way, did you realize your book is out? And, you know, I'm sitting here, I'm waiting for my complimentary copies to arrive in the mail. I said, well, what do you mean it's out? I haven't got my copies yet. He said, oh, no, it's already up on Kindle. And I pitched a fit with my publisher. I said, you do not put my books on Kindle first. I want my books to be out in hard copy first before they ever come out on ebooks. And here's the reason why. It's not that I'm against ebooks or anything like that. But for me, a hard copy of something is the record. I don't care what the federal law states about electronic signatures and electronic documents. I don't care. I want the hard copy, and here's why. If you go back to the Soviet era, even with hard copy, you would notice people appearing in some pictures with Stalin, and then magically in the next year or two in the Soviet encyclopedia, they were brushed. Yeah, they're disappearing.
Right.
With ebooks, it is much easier to change or delete an author's words.
Right.
So, you know, if you want to respect an author, folks, buy the hard copy of their book, because
that's what they intend.
It's not what Amazon intends. It's not what Barnes & Noble intends or Google. Buy the hard copy. If a book is worth having, it's worth having in hard copy.
Right. I couldn't agree more. Well, I think, is there anything else in terms of references that we want to talk about? I'd like to just touch a little bit more on the drug trade,
mm-hmm.
because I think if you look at the history of the black budget, it was clear that you needed anonymous sources of
yes.
funding in size. And the beauty of the drug budget was that you could bring drugs into a neighborhood in a way that would, one, make you money, but would allow you to take over political control of that place.
Right.
So you could buy political control with the place's own money in a way that made it was a for-profit takeover,
yep.
place by place by place.
Yep.
And it would finance the train tracks of control. And including the train tracks of the kind of violence you needed to implement control at that level, and it would allow you to continue the genocide.
Yes.
So we see a model which is, you know, you can literally see everyone going into the invention room after World War II and saying, well, what did we do right and what did we do wrong?
Right.
And one of the things they did wrong was that the concentration camps and the slave labor camps were too in your face. They got
yes.
too much resistance from the humans to do that. And so, you know, so they say, how can we come up with the same result, but in a much more profitable way? And literally, if you look at the narcotics trafficking
mm-hmm.
and the war on drugs model, they have come up with a model that allows them to harvest both the governmental budgets and the private budgets in a way that the neighborhoods pay them to take control of the place
right.
one by one by one.
That's right.
And
they had to do that for another reason, and you and I have discussed this as well. They had to have a continual flow of large amounts of money that was totally off the books, unaccounted for, free and independent of any government oversight, to fund their covert operations on the one hand, and continue that. You know, part of those covert operations are providing security for your drug traffic. So, you know, part of it has to pay for itself. And then the other thing that they need a continual flow for is for these black research projects. And again, those things soak up quite a lot of money, particularly when you're dealing with a decades long Manhattan sized project to create some very sophisticated technology. The drug trade, I think there's certain steps, and this is a whole aspect of the problem, Catherine, that I haven't even written about. I'm aware of some of it. I think there's two basic stages in the post-war aspects of this whole thing, and the first one's Vietnam. I think that if you look at their decision to go into the drug trade and so on and so forth, I think this was taken at a decision-making level within the national security establishment sometime shortly after Dien Bien Phu, when the French were defeated by the Viet Cong in Vietnam. That would have been 1954. So I think the decision was taken right around then that somehow the United States had to inject itself into Southeast Asia to get control of that aspect of the Golden Triangle drug trade and so on and so forth. Then the second period that we see them attempting to restructure the drug trade is when they take the decision in the 70s to take the French connection, take the French out of the picture, and cut off that you know, Middle East to Marseille supply route and redirect
right.
everything through Latin America. And that's where really that book that I mentioned previously that Mr. Kruger wrote, The Great Heroin Coup, that's really what that book is about.
Right.
And to be
so
honest,
there in Latin America, you have the Rockefellers and you have the Nazis.
Bingo, precisely.
And you have the drug cartels, and you have and the U.S. intelligence agencies, and you have a unique combination of forces that kind of synthesize around an enormous cash flow.
Yes, and to be honest with you, Catherine, I think this was much of the opposition to Mr. Chavez's government in Venezuela. And continuing opposition to the Venezuelan government, because whatever else one says about him, he was attempting to take steps against all of that. And of course, you know, those are four powerful enemies to have. So I think that's the second stage, is this Latin American restructuring of the drug trade and reorientating it to Latin America. And there's a third step in all of this, and I find it very disturbing, and I'm going to toss it out there. I have no sources that I can point to, Catherine, on the top of my head that can document this, but I strongly suspect, and have to this day, and that when the United States made the decision under the second Bush administration to go into Afghanistan, the first thing I thought of was drugs, that there's an aspect here of protecting the drug trade that they want to secure.
Oh, well, that was certainly a part of it.
Oh, yeah, I think so, definitely. I read recently that opium production in Afghanistan has increased dramatically recently after the American intervention. So I think I think you're looking at these three peak areas in history after the war, the Vietnam War, and then Latin America, and then finally the Afghanistan. What they're doing is they're locking down monopoly control of international drug trade.
Well, one of the things you discover, and this is global, whenever a group of soccer moms get together,
right,
or a group like the Taliban, and say, no more drugs,
right,
the next thing you know, you have all the power in the world coming down.
You
have black helicopters and James Bond come down on you.
Yep.
And the message, if you look at case after case globally, is the meta structure is deeply financially dependent.
Yep.
On those cash flows and cannot afford for it to stop. And what's interesting is they cannot afford for one neighborhood to get out, because if one can, all of them can. So they cannot afford one exception globally. It's amazing how centralized the thing is. And it gets us back to the question you and I have been asking for a long time, which is, you know, who's really running the metastructure and why are they behaving this way? Now, part is clearly a financial model.
Yeah.
But you know, but there's no doubt that there is a giant amount of money going into, you know, space programs and
right,
and unusual weaponry, and you know, that we don't begin to understand. And you cannot grapple with real questions of how do I navigate this, or where are real solutions, how can we improve the situation, until you understand that.
And let me add, yeah, I agree with you, and in fact, I agree so strongly that I think people need to understand what the implications of what you've just said are, and what we've been kind of building up to here with this. And it's something I've voiced in various blogs and other interviews, and want to do so here, and that is, everyone is pointing the fingers at quote unquote the bankers. As
mm-hmm.
being the real powers that be in this metastructure.
They're not the power.
I don't think they
power.
Are. I agree with you. I don't think they are at all. I think to a certain extent they were accustomed to being viewed so during the period prior to World War I, and then, you know, through the period up to and after World War II, and even on into, let's say, the early 60s, but I think they've long since been eclipsed in their central role in this metastructure by other factors and forces.
Right.
You know, I think that you have to look to the world intelligence agencies as being, in some sense, having co-opted the role of the bankers and basically entering the banking business themselves by President Truman's decision in 1947 vis-a-vis this whole hidden system of finance. And I think even then, I think there are other forces and factors now that are even beyond the intelligence agency's control. I think we're getting to the point where you have another factor, this breakaway civilization, that I would imagine that the technocrats, the actual scientists and engineers, are involved in the actual power and decision making in some way. And then certainly I think you have elements of the financial sector and the military sector, but I don't think that it is accurate anymore to say it's, you know, it's all the bankers and central banks and
here's the thing to understand. If you look at the subsidiary, if you look at the fronts, whether the front
right.
of Congress, whether the front is a big bank, whether the front is an insurance company, if you look at all the different fronts,
right.
the fronts, as the thing centralizes and technology allows centralization, the fronts have less and less power.
That's
they
right.
are becoming, you know, when I was on Wall Street, the people who ran a big financial institution had real power. Now
right.
they're bureaucrats. They do what they're told. And,
right.
you know, that one of the reasons I love the movie Margin Call is you see at the end that these guys are no longer principals. That's what was so frightening to me about someone like Jack Lew or Larry Summers becoming Secretary of the Treasury, because the Secretary of the Treasury was always a principal.
Right.
There was somebody who had enormous amounts of personal wealth, had built wealth, had managed real money as an equity principal holder. They understood equity at a deep, deep level. And then you started
right.
to get these staff guys
yes.
who had never built or really managed fortunes or managed big money. They're just staff guys. And what
right.
it says is the power is leaving the institution. I'll never forget being over in Congress and a senator running in. I was talking to his chief of staff. It was a senator I knew, and he came running in and he looked at me and he said, he was carrying one of these plastic cups that floats in a swimming pool. It's got a big bar on top. It's a way to have your drink in the swimming pool. And he said, I'm doing a fundraiser. What do you think of this as sort of a party favor to give to people who are, you know, coming to the fundraiser? And I looked at him and I said, Senator, I said, people in America want to believe that their senator is a very distinguished person. This won't work. And he looked at me, and the sadness in his eyes, he almost, you know, I felt like he was going to burst out crying, because he was thinking of, oh, my God, they want me to be distinguished. They really know what my life is like here and what really goes on. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
And I realized, you know, there's no power left here.
Yeah.
These guys are orders takers. They just do what
yep.
they're told.
Yep, exactly.
So, right. So the meta structure has been getting more and more powerful.
Yep,
and,
it has.
And the subsidiaries less and less, because the technology allows them to just, you know, tell people what to do. And that's the scary part, because it's, you know, the real power is disappearing into this, you know, eyes wide shut world that we can't really see very clearly.
Well, the other thing, you know, and there's a glimmer of hope here, and I hope people see what it is. The other thing that this is doing is it's allowing the real decision makers to hide. But
mm-hmm.
it's also becoming increasingly difficult for
to put up fronts.
to put up fronts, and at some point the system, you know, people are going to wake up and realize that this system is allowing people to evade responsibility. And
right.
when you have systems of evasion of personal responsibility, you know, we're back to spiritual principles and they're coming home to roost
uh-huh.
with a vengeance. Because when you're evading personal responsibility, then ultimately nothing will get done, because trust and confidence in the system breaks down.
Which is exactly what's happening. That is the number one source
exactly.
of deflation right now in the global economy. Because here's what, you know, the meta structure has always been the ultimate in passive aggressive behavior. They
right.
set up a subsidiary to do something. The subsidiary does it. They disappear back into the meta structure, and then you kill an empty structure and say, oh, see, it's fixed.
Yep.
Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
And
I
they've
sure
got
do.
The money. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, and it's
yeah.
You
no,
know,
I don't think it's hopeless at all. I would
oh
never,
no, I don't either.
Yeah.
I think people are waking up. You know, what's happening is that, as you say, the metastructure has been operating on this playbook, in my opinion, for at least 1,000 years. Okay, and the
yeah.
problem that the technology is creating for them is that everyone is now seeing the playbook, and it's all transparent, and they're not able to get away with it anymore.
Right.
So just as you say,
right.
they're
it's
you know
much
they're sitting.
Harder.
Yeah, they're sitting on top of their money and they're not spending it. And, you know, we have all the financial analysts out there that have been predicting runaway hyperinflation ever since 9/11, you know, and it's still not here. You know, and the problem is precisely what is happening is trust in the system is broken down. And I can speak to myself, I spend very differently now than I used to, and it's largely because I simply don't trust these people. <You know? laughs> I just don't. And that's a conscious decision on my part. You know,
yeah, why buy a T-shirt? It might be a bomb.
Yeah, true.
This old T-shirt is old, but I know it's a real T-shirt.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Now, two more questions before we before we close. You know, the Vatican was instrumental in helping the Nazis launder money, including down into Latin America.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, and then built very powerful financial interests in Latin America side by side with the Vatican. We have a new pope who is from Argentina.
Yes.
Any connection?
Oh,
any
absolutely.
Any relationship?
Well, absolutely, I think so, Catherine. I mean, let's look at the last two popes, okay? Actually, let's look at the last three. None of them are Italian. The first
right.
of the non-Italian popes, let's recall the circumstance here. We had the P2 scandal in Italy.
Right.
Shortly after that, we had the election of Albino Cardinal Luciani, the Patriarch of Venice, who was Pope John Paul for all of 30 days, okay? And bless his heart, this pope, from all indications, was in the process of trying to figure out what in the name of sense had just happened with this whole P2 thing and why are so many archbishops and bishops and cardinals involved with it. And there's, you know, I'm one of those to this day that believes that that man was murdered because he was planning,
yeah,
I think, yeah, I think he was planning just a tremendous house cleaning. So you had Pope John Paul I murdered, and then you had the election of Karol Cardinal Wojtyla of Krakow. And so he becomes pope. So we have the first non-Italian pope in hundreds of years, okay? And he's associated, of course, with Cardinal Wyszynski and Minzenti and those famous Eastern European cardinals that were so symbolic of opposition to the Soviet regime. And, of course, John Paul II played a really hard ball geopolitical game with the Soviet Union. And as a matter of course in doing so, I think that Wojtyla became to a certain extent beholden to or at least cooperative with the Western power elite in a way that previous popes would have shied away from. Then when he passes, his cardinal in charge of the Congregation for the Propagation of the Faith, Ratzinger, is elected, and he becomes the first German pope in decades. And, of course, Ratzinger had his own dealings with the Nazis, having been a Hitler youth and so on. I'm not saying that he was a Nazi, but he certainly played his role, I think, in covering
up. Well, here's the other thing. He was... The Vatican, until the telecoms and the digital communication technology took over,
uh-huh.
the Vatican ran the premier control file network globally
sure.
in the world.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that control file network depended on pedophilia.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
So it was his job to manage, you know, the Vatican very unfairly, taking full responsibility for that global control file network. And so you know that network had to have crisscrossed somehow with the Nazi networks.
Oh, yes,
it
absolutely.
It could not.
It could not have done anything.
Because you're talking
but.
About the control file network necessary to make the global narcotics trafficking go.
Absolutely, and I think there's something deeper there that Ratzinger may have known or had been used against him, and that is, I think this whole pedophilia network stretches into this country and is intimately related to the Franklin scandal and Penn State and
oh, yeah.
things that were happening in California, you know, back in the turn of the last century.
Yeah, this was,
you know,
the Vatican had this going in every county.
Oh,
this
yeah.
This had nothing to do with horny priests. This had to do with building control files and personnel benefits across the board
that made the organized crime go. Yeah, I tend to agree with you. Ratzinger, I think, there's something about his resignation that has all the signs of having been forced out. And now we have the election of Jorge Cardinal, I forget what his last name was, but Francis, coming from Buenos Aires, I strongly suspect, I have no evidence, so people please understand that, but I strongly suspect that he represents, first of all, a long-term strategic shift in the thinking of the cardinalate that runs the Vatican City-State on the day-to-day basis. We have to remember the Pope is their figurehead. So
right.
they signal transitions in long-term policy by who they elect. And that election signals the fact that the Vatican recognizes that the heart of Roman Catholicism is no longer going to be Europe. Recall that Ratzinger, when he was Pope, was very high on trying to re-evangelize Europe. I think that Francis represents a definite turn on the Vatican's part to reorient their power base to the second and third world, where it already is, but this is just recognition of the fact that that hierarchy is going to become preeminently important within the Vatican. But the other thing that disturbs me about his election, Catherine, is that I do think that he represents a candidate that was selected precisely for his amenability to that metastructure, particularly as you outlined its influence in Latin America with the Rockefeller interests, the drug cartels, the Nazis,
right,
and so on there. I think that that's a disturbing sign. And it's interesting that some of the first things he does once he gets into the Vatican is this so-called house cleaning of the Vatican Bank. I think that this is an attempt to possibly, again, I'm speculating here, I think this is an attempt possibly to reassert a more direct Western metastructure control over that institution.
Certainly looks at it like it, because if you look at what the Italian government is doing and forcing against the Italian mafia at the same time, it's almost like the Italian mafia is getting cleaned out and the metastructure is getting put in.
Yes, that's precisely the way I'm looking at it. I think you're looking
right.
at a restructuring of, let's put it differently, I think you're looking at a restructuring of the criminal underground element of the metastructure. And that they are taking the mafia, so to speak, out of the senior management position. let's put it just that bluntly.
It's getting corporatized.
Exactly. Exactly.
And if you look at what happened with the great heroin coup in the 70s in the United States, that's part of what happened.
Yep.
What happened here. Okay, so there's one other thing I have to bring up,
sure,
which is, you know, we're not quite sure how it connects to the Nazis, but... did I ever tell you the story of my Invisible Man experience?
No.
Okay, I have to tell you the story, and we're going to get back to your most recent blog post. I was in San Francisco in the early 2000s, and I'm right in the middle of the litigation, so I get off the plane, and I'm immediately being followed. I thought, why am I being followed? That's strange. So I go to the place that I'm staying, and then the next morning I have a meeting down near Bryant Park in San Francisco, and I take off, and I'm being followed. And it's one of those situations where the guy who's following me, I know he's following me, he knows he's following me, he knows I know he's following me. You know, it's almost like, you know, it gets to be a friendly thing. It's like having a little, you know, it's like having a puppy that follows you around or something. Anyway, so I go up to the office. Everybody wants coffee. There's a fabulous coffee shop up on Bryant Park, as it was at that time. And so I leave the office. I walk up to the coffee shop, and he follows me. And of course, he knows I know he's following me. So I get the coffee, and I come back, and he decides to just head back to the office building in front of me. you know, it's a little bit more subtle than if he follows me.
Right.
So Bryant Park at the end comes in a corner, and then you turn a corner, it gets small right at the, you know, it's like a square, and it comes in as it dunks out. And anyway, so I'm right behind him. He goes around the corner and turns, and then I come around the corner, and he's gone. He's just gone.
Oh, you're
gone.
Kidding.
He's not there. I mean, and it's not physically possible that he's not there. There's no place he could go that fast.
Oh, my word. He just disappears.
He just disappears. So I called somebody who used to be relatively high up in the intelligence agencies, and I said, you know, can you guys push a button on your belt and disappear? Do you have invisible man technology? And
uh-huh.
He said, yes, we do. Now, that doesn't make it true, but, well, what was funny was, you know, I had other experiences like
uh-huh.
that where,
uh-huh.
you know, I won't go into the details, where it could only be explained by invisible man technology. So I get on your blog this morning, and what do I find? A link to a story talking about scientists have come up with the ability to, you know, transport matter from one place to another.
Yes.
And I thought, oh, great, now Nazi International and the metastructure have this.
Have quantum teleportation on top of it. Well,
right.
You know, there have been stories out on the internet from various people for a number of years that they've had this. I don't report on stories that are simply whistleblowers, you know, concocting a story. But I have heard stories like yours from various people over the years, and I don't discount them, because it's at the minimum what my blog post talks about, Catherine, is at the minimum they are studying this stuff.
Right.
That is
absolutely
known. You know, my blog talks about the Chinese government making these types of studies, but the article I'm referring to is a big paper on the Chinese research that was written by a fellow for Edwards Air Force Base. And, you know, it's that raises all sorts of alarm bells.
The reason
right
I bring it, one of the reasons I wanted to bring this up is the thing to stress again and again about the Nazis at the end of World War II
mm-hmm.
is you're talking about people whose accomplishments in terms of technology and weaponry technology was
mm-hmm.
unsurpassed.
Oh,
and,
absolutely.
And I think it was you who said earlier the Manhattan Project might never have gotten accomplished without collapsing in some of those scientists.
Well, yeah, the very first book in that whole long Nazi series, Reich of the Black Sun, is really an important book, because it's kind of an overview of the case that has been made by some German researchers in the aftermath of German reunification, when they've gone in and looked at the old installations in the occupied zone in East Germany and so on, and had access to the archives. And the other thing that people need to understand, Catherine, is that German reunification was a signal event, not just geopolitically and financially in terms of international finance and geopolitics, you know, just the idea that we're all one big happy Reich again, you know.
Well, it was really funny, you know, when they announced after 9/11 that we were going to call this the Department of Homeland Security, I thought, is this a coming out party?
Yeah, exactly. You know, Heimat Sicherheitsdienst, you know, it's just... When I heard that too, I had the exact same reaction, Catherine. I thought, oh, you've got to be kidding me, you know. And I had a very nice gentleman that was dating my mom. She was still alive at the time, elderly gentleman, and I was literally at the very bottom of my financial fortunes at that particular point. And he told me I ought to get a job with Homeland Security, and I just looked at him. I said, do you realize that institution is a fascist institution? And he looked at me and he said, what do you mean? He said, you know, this is a World War II veteran. And I proceeded to lay it out for him. And he said, oh, my word, I had no idea. I said, yeah, Homeland Security, Heimat Sicherheitsdienst, you know.
Right.
I mean, how much more
have
obvious
ever,
can it be? But anyway, let me get back to
the song. Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, let me get back to German reunification and why it's a signal event for another very important reason. And that is, And most people, I think, will understand what I'm talking about once I mention it. German reunification is the event that kicks loose all of the classified documents. If you look
at... Oh, you're right.
Yeah,
right,
if you look,
right.
if you look at
right.
what I put in Reich of the Black Sun, for example, all of the documents that I cite there are documents, for the most part, with one significant exception, that are declassified either in the late years of the first Bush administration, the one that you served under, or the very, very early years of the Clinton administration, and most of them after German reunification under President Clinton, all right? The reason that German reunification is the event kicking loose this round of declassification, and folks, please understand, this isn't just in the United States that this is happening. This is in the Soviet Union or Russia. This is in Poland. This is in France. This is in Great Britain. The reason why is that the physical installations that were built by the SS to conduct some of this top secret research were once again open for public viewing and scrutiny. And what happened after the reunification was you had a bunch of Germans that were had always been questioning the Allied legend of you know, German nuclear incompetence during the war. And they were able to go back into these installations and examine them. And they were able
right.
to start piecing things together. So at this point, it became superfluous to keep all this documentation classified. And it was these German researchers who used the FOIA laws in these different countries to compel the declassifications. This is what's happened. So, you know, it's important for people to start, if you really want to be familiar with this post-war Nazi story, start with the story of their atom bomb in Reich of the Black Sun. I kind of outline or do a high overview of the case of why it may be that the Nazis actually did get the atom bomb. And as you say, that was rolled into the Manhattan Project right at the end of the war and became part
right.
of American nuclear technology.
Well, this has been fascinating.
Yeah, this has been a
always.
Good one.
Tell us again where we can find all the books. Can we come to your website and get them from there?
Yeah, you can go to my website, which is www.GizaDeathStar.com. That's GizaDeathStar.com. It's all lowercase, all one word. And then on the website, in the gray bar, they'll see a little tab that says bookstore, and you can get all of my books right off my website. And that's from both publishers.
Okay, fantastic. And we have one more book that you've published that we have to do. Maybe we'll do the next quarterly report on Financial Vipers. But
okay.
We hear there's another one coming, maybe?
Yeah, I'm doing a book right now that is a sequel to Financial Vipers of Venice, and then another book I wrote in 2006 called Cosmic War, and the subtitle of that is Interplanetary Warfare, Modern Physics, and Ancient Texts. So I put that out there because I know that people are going to be scratching their heads, what do those two have to do with each other? basically, this book is all the things I didn't say in Financial Vipers of Venice, the things that would have clouded the case I was trying to make there if I had referred to these things. And so I'm revisiting some things, but adding the hidden text, so to speak.
Well, we look very much forward to the next Solari report, which we will do 3 months hence. We're going to do quarterly, so we've got 4 coming this year. We're very excited. Anyway, Dr. Farrell, it is always a pleasure.
I encourage
everybody listening to this to please, you know, one way to avoid the risk that these all run up to $100 price used on Amazon, just go get all your Farrell library now and then do as I do. Get the whole pile going in the den, and then you have them and you can read them at your leisure. So, Dr. Farrell, we wish you Godspeed. Thank you again for a wonderful Solaria report. You have a great evening.
You too, Catherine. Thank you for having me back on. God bless.